last. You and Trace, you stuck with it.
It wasn't easy, Maya promised.
Yeah, I used to think there was a perfect match out there for everybody, you know? Alex told me that. Older I get, I realize there's just matches you make work and matches you give up on. Ain't nothing perfect about it.
You'll find the right person, Garrett. He scratched his beard.
That's not what worries me. Question is, will the right person stick around?
In the dim light, the lines on his face seemed deeply etched. His hair looked even more gray than usual. He gazed down at Lane Sanford as she slept, as if trying to memorize her face. Maya felt the baby kick. She put her hand against her belly. A boy, she thought. And though she'd never been religious, she prayed, please, let him be healthy.
Why don't you get some sleep, darling? Garrett told her. I'll wake you if anything happens.
She wanted to stay up. She wanted to wait for Trace to return safely. But her eyelids were as heavy as lead. She closed them and drifted off, imagining Trace holding the hand of the baby as he took his first step away from her. Chapter 27
Tell me, I said.
Jose took his eyes from the broken window.
Señor?
You didn't want me to come in here. What happened to Alex?
He shook his head, no longer evasive, just bewildered.
I don't know.
A shard of glass shook loose from the window frame. It flew past us, embedding itself in the wall.
Señor, we must leave, Imelda said. Señor!
I pushed toward the window, screening my face with my hands. The dark shape of the lighthouse loomed through the horizontal rain. The ocean churned below, waves surging against the side of the house. If Alex had fallen into that maelstrom, there was no chance of finding him. I yanked the piece of red fabric off the window, a piece of Alex's shirt, no doubt about it.
Señor, Imelda shouted over the storm, please!
Wind buffeted me back into the room. I didn't want to leave, but the glass and debris were too dangerous to contend with. I stepped back and tripped over something hard. I looked down. It was a wooden statue of a woman, about 2 feet tall, carved from cedar. The details, especially the face, were amazingly intricate. She had her arms crossed, one hand raised palm up, as if she were asking a question. My mouth tasted like metal. I was sure of 2 things about the statue, 2 things that were impossible to reconcile. First, this was the same statue I'd seen Alex Huff carving when I was a child, the day I surprised him in the lighthouse. Second, the woman's face looked a lot like a young mother I'd recently seen in a photograph. She looked like Rachel Lindy Brassos. Garrett crumpled the piece of red fabric.
You're telling me Alex jumped?
I doubt it was suicide. If he went out that window, he was pushed.
No way, little bro. So his window was broken. So what? Half the windows in the place are broken.
It was busted from the inside.
He's not dead, Garrett insisted. We gotta search the house.
I didn't answer. I didn't mention the wooden statue I'd left in the bedroom. I still couldn't process what I'd seen. The adult face of Rachel Brassos. Carved in cedar by Alex Huff when Rachel and he would have both been teenagers.
Fine, Garrett said.
He glanced over at the beds where Maya and Lane were both asleep.
I'll search outside, little bro. You stay here for a change.
Garrett, you can't. It's too dangerous. His stare was a little on the crazy side.
I'm not gonna sit here if something's happened to Alex.
We'll find him, I promised. But I was thinking about the ocean pounding the walls of the house, washing over the entire island. There was a loud knock behind me.
Trace!
Benjamin Lindy stood in the doorway, looking weary and rumpled from his time with the college guys. He'd lost his tie. A strand of gray hair curled over his forehead, geriatric Superman style.
I need to talk to you.
What a coincidence, I said. I turned to Garrett. Give me 2 minutes. We'll figure it out. Garrett glared at me like I just suggested torching a Jimmy Buffett album, but he nodded grudgingly. 2 minutes. At the end of the hall, Lindy looked around to make sure we were alone.
That young man, Ty. I took him to the bathroom just now.
That's terrific news.
You don't understand. He asked me to take him to the bathroom in his own room to get some Tylenol. He orchestrated that so he could talk to me away from his friends.
And? Lindy's eyes were as cold as steel.
He has something to tell you privately. He says it has to do with Chris Stowall's murder.
Ty sat at the bottom of the stairwell, watching the water lap against the steps. In the dim light of the hallway fixture, he looked like a wax figure, his face soft and sallow.
Chase and Markey?
He asked nervously.
Mr. Lindy's keeping them occupied.
This is a bad idea, he said.
Forget it, Ty.
You got me down here. What did you want to tell me? He chewed at his thumb.
You should have let me leave last night. You don't understand what they're into. What they're doing to me.
The fear in his voice was beyond claustrophobia. I thought about the way Markey had sapped Ty with a roll of quarters. No emotion in his face. Just cold efficiency. Few things would make a kid that age develop that kind of ruthless edge.
Those drugs they sedated you with, I said. Where did they get them?
Ty laughed weakly.
Starting to catch on, huh?
You're trying to tell me Chase and Markey are dealers?
Dealers? Man, that sounds so small. For the UT campus, those two are the freaking Walmart of drugs.
Chase and Markey can barely open a tequila bottle. Are you sure we're talking about the same people?
Ty spit into the water.
That's what they want you to think.
Oh, they're just stupid kids. It isn't possible.
Bullshit. Those two haven't been kids since elementary school.
The hall light flickered. I sat next to Ty. Together we watched foam and dark water course down the hallway.
Why are you telling me this? I asked.
They're your friends. They're my bosses. They got hooks in me like you wouldn't believe. I agreed to do this one last trip to clear my debts. I didn't agree to murder.
You think they killed Chris?
Chris was part of the system. That money you found, that came from Chase and Markey. They paid him off every time they came down.
But why would they kill him?
Ty shook his head miserably.
This was supposed to be the last run before the hotel shut down. Chris was pretty bummed about that. Maybe he leaned on Chase and Markey for more money.
Again, I thought about Chris's journal, the comments he'd made about escaping to Hawaii, his anger at Alex for closing the hotel.
So, you've been smuggling in drugs from Mexico. What are we talking about? Heroin? Marijuana?
Oh, man. That is old school. We brought in Mexican pharmaceuticals. Ritalin, Oxycontin, codeine, you name it. That's what the people in the dorms want. Prescribe your own high.
You could get pharmaceuticals here,
in cheap bulk shipments. Easier to arrange that from Mexico. Warehouse security down there is a joke. Plus the cartels and federales don't bother you. They're all focused on the illegal stuff.
How were the drugs brought in?
Fishing boat. See, that's the thing. You said there was no way off the island until the ferry? Maybe that's not exactly true. Chase and Markey had this plan.
Steps in the hallway above. Chase called down.
Yo, Ty. You all right, man?
Ty closed his eyes and swallowed.
Yeah. I feel like shit, but I'm better, I guess.
Chase and Markey came down the steps. They checked us out, trying to read what was going on.
He's not making much sense, I told them.
You gave him too much sedative.
He'll be okay, Chase said.
Come on, buddy.
Ty gave me one last look, like a convict going back inside the pen. Then he let his buddies lead him up the stairwell. I went back to our refugee room, wanting to talk to Maya, but she was still asleep. For once, she looked comfortable. I didn't want to disturb her. Lane slept more fitfully. She was mumbling something that sounded like a protest. Garrett lay next to her, his arm around her waist. He glanced up as I came in. We had a brief silent conversation that went something like this. Me? No sign of Alex. Garrett, if I could get up without waking Lane, I'd beat you with a large stick. Search again. I checked the next room and found Benjamin Lindy asleep on the couch. Chase and Markey sat on the bed having a quiet, earnest conversation with Ty. I decided to move on. The next bedroom's door was also open, but Jose and Imelda were nowhere to be seen. What now? There was too much to think about, too much trouble besides the storm blowing through this hotel. I stood at the end of the hall, looking down the stairwell into the shadows. I thought about the story Ty had told me. Given my past luck, I shouldn't have been surprised to find myself cooped up with a trio of drug dealers, as well as a paid assassin. I had no trouble believing that Chris Stowall had been making money by helping drug runners. In South Texas, that was a well-established part of the economy, right up there with ranching, drilling for oil, and making acrylic rattlesnake toilet seats for the tourists. Still, I doubted Chris had died because of a drug deal. Certainly Jesse Longoria wouldn't have come down here for anything as petty as a crate of Mexican Valium. Both of them had been playing a much more dangerous game. I rubbed my eyes. I kept seeing Rachel Brassus's face, carved in wood. Two bodies downstairs, and the death that haunted me most was a lady I'd never known. I imagined Ralph Arguello laughing.
You hang out with the dead too much, Vato.
No contest, I pleaded. Then I turned and headed toward Alex Hoff's bedroom. Inside, the storm had sprayed everything with broken glass and sand like sugar coating on a pan dulce. Somebody, probably Jose, had nailed a quilt over the smashed window. The wind and rain had already ripped it to shreds. I wondered if it was just wishful thinking or if the storm sounded a little less intense now. It wasn't much louder than your average booster rocket. I picked up the wooden statue and set it on the dresser. She still looked like Rachel, her hand out, asking some question I couldn't answer. I went through Alex's dresser drawers, then his closet. After 10 minutes of turning his room upside down, I'd found nothing remarkable, nothing except the statue. And that bothered me. I knew Alex well enough to know that I should have found some memorabilia. The photos he'd once shown me from his fishing expeditions, his dad's army knife, maybe the signed Jimmy Buffett poster Garrett had given him for his 20th birthday. Despite his temper, Alex Hoff was a sentimentalist. He kept old things. He remembered people he'd known as a child. He'd spent his life savings to buy this hotel because it had been dear to his father. And yet this room looked like any other room in the hotel, except for the wooden statue of the dead woman. I got up and went to the window. The wind was definitely slacking now. Its howl was less insistent. Woven Guatemalan pictures rippled across the tattered quilt. Men with machine guns, helicopters over a rainforest. On an impulse, I ripped it down. I was standing there, staring into the angry edge of the dying hurricane, when the hotel's power went out again. As my eyes adjusted to the deeper darkness, I noticed something out in the storm, a flicker of light, and then it was gone. I must have imagined it. Storms can play a lot of tricks with the light. But I was pretty sure I'd just seen a candle extinguished in the top window of the old lighthouse. Chapter 28. Calavera squatted in the dark stairwell, listening to the noises of the house. 4 in the morning was a good time for murder. He wouldn't normally choose to work in a house that was occupied. This had already caused him problems, almost given him away. But under the circumstances, he had no choice. He set his hand on the unpainted timbers. The walls here were so close together his shoulders touched on either side. He remembered his first job, so much like this one. A police commander, a judge, and a lawyer walked into the brothel. It sounded like the beginning of a joke, but the three men would never come out alive. Calavera had spent weeks studying their habits. He knew they would stay overnight on Sunday, as they always did, and so Calavera had visited on Saturday as a client. In the early morning, when everyone was asleep, he had laid the trap. Monday at 4 a.m., he watched from the building across the street. He lay on the roof with a rifle, just to be sure. The brothel's back doors were barricaded. He'd seen to that. If anyone came out the front or made it through a window, he would take care of them. He didn't like loose ends. He needn't have worried. The explosion was beautiful. Flame blossoming simultaneously in the windows. The screams were short-lived, and no one came out of the building. The display was better than fireworks. Blood rushed through his veins. He felt more alive than he had in years. Soon, setting bombs had become his addiction. The money was good, necessary for his survival, but he'd have done the work without pay. He had finally found something he was good at. Now, he wished he could recapture that thrill. But this time was different. Necessary, yes. But he'd take no pleasure from it. He connected the last wire to a simple timer. So much could be accomplished with a single electrical pulse. He sat for a few moments, listening to the sounds of sleepers on the other side of the wall, gentle snoring, restless turning in bed. Tomorrow, he would be away from here. He'd start again, and this would be his last display. A work of necessity, hastily done. He didn't like that. But the beauty of fire wiped out one's imperfections. Fire was very forgiving. He set the candy skull on the timer, knowing no one would ever see it, but he would know it was there. Small, sugary eyes, watching as the seconds ticked down in the dark. Chapter 29. I meant to venture out into the storm to investigate the lighthouse. Instead, I went to check on Maya, lay down next to her, thinking it would only be a few minutes, and ended up falling asleep. So much for the intrepid hero of the tempest. Most of my dreams were surreal, kind of like my life. Unfortunately, this time I dreamed about the day I quit private investigations, and that dream was always exactly true to life. I was in my office, the converted dining room of our Victorian on South Alamo. It was winter in San Antonio. The wall furnace hissed. Outside, the sky was heavy gray, and the bare pecan trees looked like charred bones. I just returned from San Fernando Cemetery from my encounter with U.S. Marshal Longoria at Ralph's graveside. Longoria's words kept coming back to me. If you can't stop feeling guilty, son, maybe you should find a different line of work. I had a pile of paperwork on my desk, a few skipped traces, a divorce case, an undercover job I needed to set up with a local jewelry store. I also had a stack of essays to grade from my part-time teaching gig at UTSA. I was trying to decide whether I wanted to write a report about my client's cheating husband or grade sophomore papers on Chaucer's use of alliteration. The fun factor seemed about the same either way. Maya was in the living room, talking on the phone with her doctor. She'd been on the phone since I got home. I tried not to think about that. She was constantly telling me not to worry. The doctor was probably trying again to convince her to do amniocentesis. She was politely but firmly saying no. She wasn't showing too much yet. She had white paint flecked on her fingers. She spent the morning painting the baby's room upstairs, even though I told her she should take it easy. I checked my email. I had a lot of messages. My boss at UTSA asking again if I wouldn't reconsider taking another course. They were short-handed, as usual. He could easily move me into a full-time position. He mentioned the magic words. health care. There was a message from a client thanking me for finding her runaway daughter. There was an email from Anna De Leon, Ralph's widow, with a photo attachment of their baby girl, Lucia. Lucia had her father's crazy grin as she dumped the candy out of her Christmas stocking. Worst of all, there was a Happy New Year e-card from Rosa Gomez, the lady who had hired me to find her fugitive husband. I didn't know why Rosa kept me on her holiday list. She claimed I was the only one who listened to her, the only one who even tried to help her husband. I'm not sure I would have been so generous in her position. I'd failed her miserably. I shouldn't have tortured myself, but I found a file on Julio Gomez and looked through it again. Like homicide detectives, PIs get certain cases that just won't let you go. They're never resolved. They haunt you. I'd never even met Julio Gomez, but I knew him well. His photo showed a thin Latino in his late 20s, a good smile, intelligent eyes. He didn't look like a criminal. You wouldn't latch your door if you saw Julio Gomez walking down your street. When he was 17, he'd been messing around on a highway overpass with some friends, throwing rocks down at cars. One rock went through a Ford pickup's windshield with the force of a cannonball and killed a passenger. Julio had been tried as an adult, but he managed a plea deal, involuntary manslaughter, light sentence. That had been his first strike. When he was 21, he'd gotten in a fight at a bar. Unfortunately, the man had been an off-duty cop. This got Julio an assault conviction and a bad reputation among the city's police. When he got out of jail again, Julio married his longtime sweetheart, Rosa. Julio tried to go straight, despite the fact that the cops often harassed him, knowing he had a short temper. Julio was doing all right, holding down a job, thinking about community college. Then the gas station where Julio worked was burned to the ground a few days after Julio had argued with his boss. Julio was brought up on arson charges. He made bail, panicked, and ran. He told Rosa he couldn't take another felony count. More jail time would kill him. Rosa was our down-the-street neighbor. She passed my business sign every day on her way to work. She came to me, begging me to find her husband. Julio was innocent of arson. Julio had to come back and stand trial. I never found him. Within a few days, rumors started surfacing about Jesse Longoria. The marshal had been asking questions about Julio, following the same trail I had, except Longoria had been more efficient and more ruthless. What bothered me most was that I never found the body. I couldn't prove what had happened. I couldn't give Rosa any closure. All I had were suspicions. But that morning at the cemetery, Longoria's smile had given me all the proof I needed. I thought about his pleasant eyes, his black wool coat, his gold college ring. He was a hunter with no remorse. He had found Julio Gomez, probably put a bullet through his head, dumped the body, and gone out afterward for dinner and a show. He would have done the same for Ralph Arguello, or me for that matter, if we'd happened to cross him. Why did I want people like that in my life? I slipped Julio Gomez's file back into my cabinet. I stared at the picture of my dead best friend's daughter, Lucia, on my computer screen. Anna De Leon's brief note, "Love from the both of us." I closed the email program. In the living room, Maya hung up the phone. She sat with her fingers laced, staring at the coffee table. I knew she was gathering her composure before she came to talk to me. Especially during the first trimester, pregnancy had played hell with her hormones. She got emotional much more easily than usual, and she hated it. She spent a lot of time alone at the coffee table. In 6 months, give or take, I would be a father. When I thought about the legacy I had from my own dad, what did I come up with? His old service revolver, a warped view of law enforcement, and some painful memories from a childhood spent on Revel Island. I stared at the telephone. Then I picked it up and dialed my boss at UTSA. I told him I was thinking of going full-time. He said he'd start the paperwork immediately.
Chapter 30 Benjamin Lindy watched the sunrise through a hole in the wall. He'd always been an early riser. When he was a child, his job had been to tend the chickens on the ranch. He'd get up before first light and check for eggs, remove snakes from the hutch when necessary, and let the chickens out to feed. Early rising had been bred into him. It was a physical need. Around 4 a.m, his feet would start to tingle, and the sheets would begin to feel itchy. He had to get out of bed. On the rare occasion when he overslept and woke up to daylight, he felt sluggish and out of sorts, cheated of his best time. This morning, he'd had several hours to think before the sun came up. He decided he would have to kill someone today. The room he was standing in had been a parlor suite. Sometime during the night, a telephone pole had pierced the wall, cross beams, wires, and all. It stuck about 5 feet into the room, hanging crookedly in the ragged hole it had made, the top of the pole pushing against the ceiling. Lord knew where the telephone pole had come from. There were none on the island, as far as Benjamin could recall. When he came into the room, his first impression was that a sailing ship had rammed the building with its bowsprit. He slipped his hand into his pocket. The gun was still there. It was his spare sidearm, too small for his hand, but now he was glad he'd brought it. Years ago, he'd bought the gun for his wife, but she'd never touched it, one of the many things she'd left behind. He supposed there was some sort of justice in him using that gun today. He watched the sky turn from black to steel. He still burned from the indignity of having his .45 taken from him, as if he were a child. A year earlier, the state had tried to take away his driver's license simply because he was old. Then a murderer had taken away his daughter, as if old age didn't rob a man of enough. Navarre had no right to rule over him. Benjamin had been wrong to trust Navarre. He would do no more than the law. He remembered his last conversation with Peter Brassos, who of all people should have been his ally. Peter had turned all his attention to prosecuting the drug lords. He poured his rage into his work. But Calavera, Peter saw the assassin as a tool, not the real target. When Benjamin had tried to warn him what the Marshal Service was doing, tried to suggest they take action before the assassin could cut a deal, Peter had shut him down. "Not another word," Peter snapped. "Ben, this conversation never happened. If they can bring the bastard in, I'm all for it. I want his boss's names, all of them. But you will do nothing outside the law. Do you hear me? Nothing." Benjamin backed down. He pretended compliance, and they hadn't spoken since. Outside, the rain still fell, but the storm was dying. Today, Calavera would try to escape. Benjamin wasn't sure how, but he couldn't allow anyone to leave the island, not until the assassin was dead. He would have to watch. He replayed last night in his mind. His brief conversation with Ty had bothered him. Those boys were up to no good. Ty knew something about Stowall's murder, but he'd wanted to talk to Navarre. He wouldn't tell Benjamin anything. Then there was Alex Huff, the way he'd left abruptly last night. And now where was he? Every time Benjamin looked at Huff, he had to constrain his anger. It couldn't be a coincidence that the trail to his daughter's murderer had led here, to this vile hotel. The very existence of the place was an insult to him. And Alex Huff, he would have to be found. Benjamin rested his hand on the telephone pole. He'd have to be patient a little while longer. He would have to control his anger. But when the time came, he couldn't hesitate. Blood for blood today. No one would take that away from him.
Chapter 31 As dawn broke, I stood at one of the many shattered windows on the second floor and surveyed the aftermath of Hurricane Aidan. It was still raining hard, like white noise rather than water.
The northern stretch of the island had disappeared under the waves. As far as I could see, which was only about 200 yards, the gulf churned in a foamy gray soup that blurred into the sky. The main bulk of the island had been reduced to a few acres around the hotel. The path was scoured away. The remaining palmetto trees were stripped of fronds. The boat dock had vanished. But as the waves swept back, the tips of the old pilings peaked above the water. In front of me, the lighthouse rose dark and undamaged. Even the glass of the lantern house seemed to have survived the storm, which seemed impossible, insulting, really. But no light flickered in the windows, no sign of movement. I still needed to check out the light I'd seen the night before, but I wasn't anxious to brave the rain again. I was steeling my nerves to go downstairs when I heard a cough behind me.
"Is it over?"
Lane Sanford asked. She was standing bleary-eyed in the doorway. Her hair was flat on one side. She had pillow wrinkles on her cheek.
"Looks that way," I said. "What brings you here?"
"This is my room."
I might have blushed. I hadn't even noticed the dresses hanging up in the closet, the makeup kit on the bathroom sink. The door had been open, the room soaked with rain like all the others. I just walked right in. The past night in the hotel had eroded my sense of private property.
"Sorry," I murmured.
"It's okay."
She came to the window and looked out. The sky was getting incrementally brighter. I still couldn't see the sun, but there was a yellow quality to the gray, like butter in oatmeal. Lane looked healthier in the light. The wrinkles around her eyes might have been from smiling rather than weariness. Her blonde hair had a silky sheen.
"When will the ferry come?" she asked.
"It's more likely the Coast Guard will get here first. They'll have some fast boats riding out the storm."
She strained her eyes toward the horizon, as if trying to imagine such a boat. I could relate. After last night, the idea of rescue, the notion of anything could exist beyond Rebel Island, seemed as fantastic as pink elephants.
"My ex-husband was never here," she said softly. "I owe you an apology."
Out on the ocean, something surfaced. A gleaming white arc of fiberglass, the bottom of a capsized boat, and sank again instantly beneath the waves.
"Why did you run from him?" I asked.
"He murdered a man."
"Who?"
Lane hugged her arms.
"I don't even know his name. Isn't that terrible? He was a migrant worker. Bobby and I lived near the train tracks outside Uvalde. One afternoon in March, while Bobby was at work, this man knocked on the kitchen door. He asked me for a drink of water. I shouldn't have let him in."
"You let a stranger into your home?"
"He was thirsty and hungry. He was about to collapse. I didn't see why not."
"I could think of a lot of reasons. A young woman alone in the country, letting a strange man into her house. But the way she said it made it sound like the most reasonable thing in the world."
"I was alone most days," she told me. "It was hot. I had a kitchen window open, and I was slicing apples. The whole house smelled like wheat from the fields. The man who came to the door, he had dark skin. He wore an old denim shirt, beige pants. His tennis shoes were worn through. He spoke good English. He said he'd hitched a train all the way from Piedras Negras. He had a wife and 4 children. He wanted to find work so he could send them money."
I pictured the scene. Lane at one end of the kitchen table, listening to the immigrant's story. It wasn't hard to see why the man had opened up to her. When she wasn't terrified, her face was kind and open.
"He ate a turkey sandwich and some apple slices and a glass of milk," she remembered. "Then Bobby got home."
She fell into a kind of trance as she told the rest of her story. It was as if she'd practiced it in front of the mirror many times, trying to make herself understand. "Bobby never came home before dark," she said. "But that day he did. He'd had an argument with his foreman and walked off the job. He stopped at a store in Uvalde, bought a 6-pack of beer and downed 3 of them in the truck on the way home. When he found the Mexican sitting at his kitchen table, he turned on Lane. He struck her across the face, called her a whore. The Mexican man rose and told Bobby to stop.
Bobby grabbed a kitchen knife, the same one Lane had been using to slice apples, and the Mexican man lifted his hands, as if that would stop the blade. Hours later, after dark and a lot more alcohol, Bobby buried the Mexican. He forced Lane to help. They dragged the body to a creek bed behind their rented property and spent hours digging a hole in the wet black earth. Afterward, he told Lane he had only been protecting her. He drove the point home with a good beating. He'd only done what he had to do, killing that Mexican. If she told anyone, he would kill her. Lane had no doubt he meant it. 3 months later, she finally got up the nerve to run.
"I knew he'd never let me go," she told me. "He's still looking for me."
"Go to the police," she shook her head.
"They'd put me in prison, too. I've stayed silent for months. I helped him hide the body. If I just hadn't let that poor man inside, or if I told him to leave a little sooner..."
"What Bobby did wasn't your fault." She brushed the rain off her face.
"I told Garrett all this. I told him he shouldn't get involved with me."
I didn't answer.
"I like him," Lane admitted. "I don't know what to do. He's the kindest man I've ever met."
"You need to get out more." She pursed her lips.
"I understand you don't approve. You don't want him to get hurt."
That stunned me.
I'd been so worried about Garrett taking advantage of Lane, I'd never thought about Garrett getting hurt. But as Lane said it, I realized she was right. I didn't want my brother falling for anyone. I'd seen him do that before. His depression when he was dumped, and he was always dumped, was terrible and dangerous. And yet, looking at Lane, I felt like some chances might be worth taking, even if they were dangerous. Maybe it was the right thing to unlatch your screen door for a stranger once in a while. Let them inside for apple slices and milk.
"I know some good lawyers," I said. "I'm married to one. We can help you work a deal with the police."
"You barely know me. You would do that for me."
"Yeah, I would."
She rested her hand on my arm. "Garrett was right about you."
"What did he say?"
"That you could solve any problem, or you'd die trying."
"I'd like to avoid the die trying part," she smiled.
"I should go check on Garrett, leave you in peace."
"It's your room."
"I just came to salvage my things."
She looked around helplessly, as if she'd already decided that mission was no good. "Lane," I said, "did you know Chris Stowall was in love with you?" Her eyes became unfocused. She stared into the storm.
"Let me know if you spot the Coast Guard."
Then she turned and left me alone with a window full of rain. I stood in front of Lane's closet and looked at her drenched clothes. A dozen cotton dresses, all pastels, all the same utilitarian style. 4 pairs of simple flat-soled shoes, 2 small brown suitcases. I had a feeling Lane had brought everything she owned. At the back of the closet, next to Lane's shoes, a black electrical cord, curled like a snake, frayed copper wires sticking up at the end. I knelt to pick it up, but it seemed to be attached, crimped between the wall and the floor. It took me a minute to process why this didn't seem right. Then my skin turned cold. I remembered last night, Lane screaming, swearing she'd seen a man in her room, a man who had vanished into the closet. I pushed aside Lane's dresses. I stepped into the closet and ran my fingers along the sides of the back wall. The latch was in the top left corner, a simple mechanism. I pulled it. The wall swung away from me. A secret door, just like Garrett had suggested. The latch was much too high for him to have found it last night. I backed out and found my flashlight. When I shone it into the closet, I saw that the secret area was narrow, no more than a few feet deep. A landing on a steep stairwell, crude wooden steps leading up and down, sandwiched between the walls of the guest rooms. At my feet was the loose piece of electrical cord that had caught my attention. I picked it up. I wondered if it had been caught under the door last night when the man had fled in haste. I swept the flashlight beam around the rest of the closet and into the stairwell, but I didn't see anything else suspicious, just the frayed cord. I stepped into the secret doorway. Down below, I could see the flash of water. The flooding hadn't discriminated. Along with everything else on the first floor, it had found this hidden stairwell. I decided to go up and began to climb. The steps were so steep they were almost a ladder, and they dead-ended at another door-sized sheet of wood. I found the latch and opened it. Voices. I was in someone else's closet, and judging from the smell of the clothes, I guessed it was a college guy's room.
"It's gotta be now," Chase was saying. "Have you looked outside, man?"
Marky's voice.
"I don't give a damn. It has to be now, or it'll be too late."
"All right," Marky growled. "Christ! Point that someplace else."
"You're both crazy," Ty said. "Please, Chase, just let it go."
"Shut your mouth," Chase snapped. "You've screwed things up enough already." Something went crunch. Unfortunately, that something was right under my foot. Conversation in the room stopped. I had two choices, back down the stairs or jump out and say, "Ta-da!" Given that Marky had just accused Chase of pointing something at him, I decided on discretion. I backed out and in the darkness relatched the wall panel. I could hear the closet door opening on the other side. I was sure Chase and Marky were going to kick in the back wall and find me. But there was silence.
"It was nothing," Chase said. "Damn storm making noises again."
"Huh," Marky said. He didn't sound convinced, but the closet door closed, and I climbed down the stairs as quickly as I could. Apparently, it wasn't my day for visiting closets. When I came back out of Lane's, I found Benjamin Lindy standing by the window. He turned as I emerged from the rack of dresses. He didn't look particularly surprised.
"Miss Sanford told me you were here, Mr. Navarre. I didn't realize she meant in the closet."
I couldn't think of another explanation, so I told him the truth. He stepped past me and checked the passage for himself. He peered up into the gloom. When he came out again, he looked troubled.
"The boys' room, you say?"
I could hear them arguing. I couldn't tell what about. He fixed me with that courtroom gaze.
"They're drug dealers, Mr. Navarre. Surely you figured that out. Now I'm wondering if they are murderers as well."
"They've got nothing to do with Calavera,
Mr. Navarre."
Lindy's voice held a touch of desperation.
"We are entering the most dangerous hours of the weekend. The storm is passing. Sooner or later, a boat will come. Calavera will be getting restless to leave this island. He cannot let us leave as well. He cannot afford to have the authorities alerted."
"You don't want the authorities alerted either," I said. "You want to resolve this yourself." Lindy didn't answer. I looked down and realized I was still holding the frayed piece of electrical cord. I felt it was important, but I didn't know why. It bothered me almost as much as the statue up in Alex's room.
"How did Chris know to contact you?" I asked Lindy. "We've been through this.
He didn't know you personally?"
Lindy hesitated. "I assume he saw the news about Rachel's murder."
"You hadn't been to Rebel Island before? You didn't know Alex Huff?"
"No.
Alex wasn't friends with your daughter? They didn't go to the school together or anything like that?"
"No," he said coldly. "Why are you asking this?"
I thought about Rachel Brass's face, carved in wood. The face of a grown woman carved while Rachel was still a child. A new mother.
"What about your wife?" I asked. Lindy's expression hardened. "What about her?"
"There were no pictures in the scrapbook. Who was she? Did Rachel look like her?" There was a sudden electricity in the room that had nothing to do with the storm. I knew I'd crossed a line Mr. Lindy would never forgive.
"That has no bearing," Lindy said.
"You said you asked Longoria's advice about your wife. She ran away, didn't she?" Lindy stared at the suitcases on Lane Sanford's bed. The rain in the window made a frame of static behind him.
My wife was a troubled woman, he said. Rachel's birth left her deeply depressed, unbalanced. She disappeared and left me to raise our daughter alone. You never found her? I stopped looking. That was Marshal Longoria's advice. She was better gone. He was right.
The bitterness in his voice was so fresh his wife might have left yesterday.
Longoria understood vengeance, I said. He wasn't so good with love. It sounds like he steered you wrong more than once. My daughter was murdered, Mr. Navarre. Her killer is here. I intend to find him.
I nodded. Maya was wondering, who's more dangerous, you or Calavera?
Don't compare us. Don't try to kill him.
A knock on the door. Jose came in, looking worried. Senores, he said, I'm sorry, but I thought I happened to see the three young gentlemen.
What about them? I asked.
They went downstairs, Jose told us. They just left the hotel.
Chapter 32. Maya and Imelda returned to the colonel's suite and found it hardly damaged at all. Rain still dripped from the ceiling into the overflowing silver cup. The air smelled of extinguished candles. The picture of Trace's father and the other two men hung crookedly on the wall. Maya sat on the edge of the bed to catch her breath. The bedspread was dry and warm.
I will pack your things, Senora, Imelda said. That isn't necessary. I can get them.
Imelda didn't seem to hear. She found the suitcase in the closet and set it at the foot of the bed.
You should be ready to leave.
It didn't take long. Maya and Trace had always been light travelers. Within a few minutes, Imelda had folded their clothes and tucked them away. She found Maya's 357 wrapped in a nightgown and held it cupped in her hands, as if unsure whether to pack it.
What's bothering you? Maya asked.
Imelda set the gun down.
I should help Jose get breakfast ready.
But Maya could sense her indecision, wanting to say something, afraid to do so. Usually, silence helped. In her practice, Maya would sit quietly for a long time, creating a space for the client's statement. Let them fill the gap with words. But Imelda didn't.
I decided, Maya told her, the baby will be a boy. And without knowing why, Maya explained her fears.
Imelda stared at her, as if she just noticed Maya for the first time.
This disease runs in your family, Senora?
Maya nodded.
My brother died when he was very young. We watched him get weaker and weaker. Grief destroyed my father. And the chances are good that your son will have this?
Yes.
But you risk it anyway. I've thought about it. I've decided I'm supposed to have this child.
Imelda pursed her lips.
I thought the same thing with my own children.
Maya waited, but once again Imelda backed off. Whatever she was afraid of saying, the fear won out.
Imelda, she said, if there's a way I can help you, you should get out of this old house, Senora. Fresh air would do you good.
It's still pouring, Maya said. Imelda folded the 357 back in the nightgown and packed it in the suitcase.
You are ready, Senora. I have to help with breakfast.
Alone, Maya reclined on the bed and listened to the rain plinking into the silver cup. She decided she should go down to the dining room just to see what was happening. But she lay still and stared at the ceiling. She thought about her old home in China, how the rain would drum against the corrugated tin roof, and how she would fall asleep listening to her brother's labored breathing until the day he died. Ever since then, she could never fall asleep in a silent room. Chapter 33. I got to the bottom of the stairs and found that the water was receding from the first floor, leaving a spongy marsh of carpet, seaweed, and salt foam. The front door had been blown off its hinges. Outside, rain made a steady downpour, but the wind was almost tolerable. Waves lapped a few feet from the base of the lighthouse. Mounds of sand stuck up here and there above the churning water. scattered bumps that emerged and disappeared with every surge. So what was left of Rebel Island reminded me of a smudged charcoal rubbing. From the outside, the hotel didn't look as bad as I'd feared. The roof had been scoured away in places, leaving a skeletal frame of beams. The windows looked more like craters. Otherwise, the building seemed intact. But something bothered me about its appearance. I couldn't decide what. I asked Benjamin Lindy to stay behind. I wasn't sure how his legs would hold up in the flood water, and, more important, I didn't like the angry look in his eyes. But, of course, he didn't listen. He followed as I trudged into the tide, looking for our college friends. It wasn't hard to spot them. They were about a quarter mile north, standing ankle-deep in the stormy water like disciples. One of the guys, red-headed Chase, was squatting down like he was looking for something. The other two stood and watched. I did a quick scan of the horizon. Nothing in any direction except storm and ocean. On a clear day, the coastline would have been visible from Rebel Island. Not today. If I hadn't known better, I would have sworn we were 1,000 miles from the mainland. I wanted to stop at the lighthouse and check on the strange flicker I'd seen the night before, but Benjamin Lindy was already ahead of me, wading purposefully toward Chase, Markey, and Ty. I didn't intend to let the old man confront them without me. We had quite enough dead bodies as it was. Chase was on his knees in the surf, clawing at the wet sand that sucked back into place as soon as he tried to scoop it out. "Dude," Markey told him, "we got company." Chase looked up at us, a vacant stare in his eyes.
"It should be here. Too great. They can't just disappear."
"He's confused." Markey slipped his hand into his pocket. "Been cooped up too long, doesn't know what he's saying." I glanced at Ty. "Maybe he needs a Valium," I suggested, "or codeine." Markey's expression darkened. He turned to Ty.
"You probed him?" I didn't." "You sorry little—"
I saw the gun coming. I punched Markey in the gut as it came out of his pocket. The gun tumbled and was lost in a cloud of wet sand. Markey sat down hard in the water.
"Don't hurt him,"
Ty yelped. It took me a second to realize he was talking to me. He was terrified I might beat up the guy who'd been about to shoot him. Markey rubbed his sore stomach. He eyed me with contempt.
"You're pretty fast for an old man."
He started to get up, but Benjamin Lindy stepped forward.
"Stay down, son, or this much older man will make you sorry. Now tell me about Calavera."
Coming from most 80-year-olds, such a threat might have been amusing. No one laughed. Markey looked at Chase and Ty. He shook his head cautiously.
"We don't know anything about that." "Calavera was connected to this island," Lindy said. "He did most of his work for the drug cartels. You were moving drugs through the island. Totally different thing, man. When the police start asking why a U.S. Marshal and your friend Chris Stowall are both dead," Lindy said, "you'll look very bad."
I had to give him credit. The old lawyer really knew how to sweat a witness. Markey squirmed like the ocean was boiling suddenly around him.
"We don't know anything about murder, okay?"
"How often did you come to the island?" I asked. "How did you make the exchanges?"
"Do you think I'm going to tell you that?" "Every 2 months," Chase cut in. "Dude, shut up!" "We'd stay for a weekend," Chase said. "The Mexicans would bring a boat on Friday night when it was dark. We'd never see them face to face. They'd bury the drugs here."
He lifted his hands. Clumps of sand dripped through his fingers.
"Later that night, we'd come down, put the stuff in bait buckets like we were fishing, right? We'd bury the payment and leave. Mexicans would pick it up. Today, Saturday morning."
"They'd leave the drugs first," I said. "They trusted you to pay?" Chase was slumped over, his spirit broken. Hard to believe he was the same smart-mouthed kid I'd picked out as the leader of the gang last night.
"Trust had nothing to do with it," he said. "You don't cross these people. Chris Stowall was the go-between, keeping an eye on the whole thing. If we tried to leave before the Sunday ferry, he would have radioed the Mexicans. We would have been dead before we got back to the mainland. Dude, why are you telling them this? Marky demanded. What does it matter? Chase said. We're dead. We're completely dead.
Explain the completely dead part, I said. Chase stared at the hole he'd made in the sand. No more than a dent now. Marky said nothing. Finally, Ty took a shaky breath.
We should have picked up the drugs last night. We couldn't because of the storm.
That's why Chase and Marky were trying to leave the hotel last night, I guessed. Ty nodded glumly.
Now it's too late. The drugs are gone. The thing is, the Mexicans won't believe us.
You didn't make up the hurricane, I pointed out.
Doesn't matter. They'll expect payment.
You brought money to pay them?
$32,000. Ty glanced at Marky. But it's gone, too. It disappeared from the room last night.
Suddenly their distress made more sense to me. No drugs, no money. Storm or not, their Mexican friends were not going to be happy.
We've got to get them to come ashore, Marky said.
They won't listen, Chase objected. Maybe not, but we take the boat.
Benjamin Lindy was studying the young men. It seemed to me his anger turned to disappointment as he did so. Once again, his vengeance was without a likely target.
What about Stowall? Did you kill him?
Hell no,
Marky said.
That's not true, Ty said. Chris was blackmailing you,
Ty. Shut up, Marky warned.
He wanted more money, Ty persisted. They had a big argument. Chris said he needed to get away fast. He wanted an extra cut. He said he could make life really bad for us. He asked if we'd ever heard of Calavera.
Marky cursed. That doesn't mean I killed him, dude.
When was this argument? I asked Ty, ignoring Marky.